Tonight on The Download, Goosebumps writer R.L. Stine, award-winning Chicago poet and author Anna Castillo, Broadway musical composer Scott Frankel, and musician John Langford. And now here's your host, a man who can't remember where he put his sandwich, Justin Kaufman.
I had it right here. I made a whole sandwich, and now it's gone. Did I eat it? I think I might have eaten it. That's okay. I just make another, eat another. Oh, so fun when you lose your food. How you doing, everybody? I'm Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN. It's a download with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Tremendous, tremendous show tonight. You know, we said yesterday we had a ton of music. Tonight we've got a ton of authors. The Printers Row Lit Fest, sponsored by the Chicago Tribune, is coming to town Saturday this weekend. I love this festival. It's one of my favorite festivals in Chicago. It's a great place to find cool, used books, all sorts of stuff, to bring your kids to see live events, and this weekend is no exception. The headliner, if you will, R.L. Stine, the author of the Goosebumps series, one of the best authors ever. I mean, children's authors aside, just the stuff that he has produced, not only for children but for teens and others. You're talking about some of the greatest books of all time. Just the Goosebumps series alone has won so many awards and has like hundreds of millions of copies circulating worldwide. R.L. Stine will join us. He's going to be at the Lit Fest this weekend. Also at the Lit Fest, Goodman Theaters, I guess you call them Goodman Theaters, a Broadway musical composer, Scott Frankel. He's composing the music for Warpaint, which is the new Goodman Theater musical starring Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole, which will be at the Goodman's Carton at the end of this month. Scott will be here. We'll talk Broadway musical. I'm so excited to have a composer and someone who writes the music. We talk, and like I told Ro and Anna, this guy was one of the, he was playing piano in Into the Woods. That's like 1987. It's one of the most successful and revered musicals of all time. They turned it into that musical with, or the movie with Meryl Streep. Into the Woods. So we'll talk with him about that. And of course, War Paint. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Anna Castillo, Chicago poet and author. She's got a new novel out, a new memoir, Black Dove. We'll talk with her. She will also be at the Lit Fest. So that's what I'm saying, a lot of Lit Fest this night. But that's not all. Chicago White Sox broadcaster Hawk Harrelson joins us. How fun is that to talk? He gone. Stretch. We're going to talk with him about his illustrious career in the booth, about being a White Sox homer, and what's going on with this team. Hawk Harrelson will join us after 9 o'clock. And at 10 o'clock tonight, I mean, just when you think like the show can't get any better, John Langford in studio playing music. John Langford of the legendary punk band The Mekons. He grew up in the UK in Welsh. He's a Welsh guitarist and drummer. And now he's here in Chicago, and he's behind the bands like Waco Brothers, Pine Valley Cosmonauts, many others. He's a fixture at the Hideout, and he's also playing Ribfest this weekend. So he's going to come in with Bethany Thomas, and they're going to bring their guitar, sing some songs. How great is that? That's The Download tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get this show on the road. It's The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Why don't we start with the carryout, our nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. President Obama is endorsing. Are you ready? Come on, it's Hillary Clinton. Everybody knows it's Hillary Clinton. Obama is excited to campaign for her, so essentially, national government is closed till November. Nope, probably January. Well, then she's going to need some time to get adjusted, so maybe next summer. But then she's going to need a vacation. She's going to be tired. So, you know what? Look for the government to get back to business by late 2017. But yeah, what if it's a cold fall? You know what? 2018. The budget impasse continues to affect Illinois. Today, Comptroller Leslie Munger listed some of the places that are hurting.
We're going to need money for K-12 education. We're also going to need money for local governments, 911 call centers, domestic violence shelters, lottery winners. You know what? I don't know why I'm reading this. We need money for everything. The Chicago Tribune successfully sued the city of Chicago to get the emails about Gary McCarthy. Mayor Emanuel was hiding them because I guess they were too nice. All they were letters of support, showing support for him as superintendent, asking how he gets his arms so big, how his mustache stays so trim. 1 in 5 Chicago public schools tested for elevated lead levels in the water. Hey, at least some Chicago public schools are getting high test scores. A new study says that not enough Americans are flossing. Yep, I guess you're supposed to floss at least once a day. Oh, you know what? I must have misread. I thought you were supposed to floss once a year. All right, my bad. No wonder my teeth have the consistency of a Twizzler. Hamilton tickets are ready to go on sale, fetching over $600 for holiday shows. Hey, for $600, I can see a Bears playoff game. I know, plenty of ways to go here. Nah, Hamilton would be better and probably showcase better footwork. Yesterday, a man fell when a subway grate gave way. What? That's like a nightmare scenario. You know the grates you walk over on State Street? That's like an old wives' tale come true. And imagine falling down there. I wonder if the rats were hospitable. Chipotle stock dropped today after a new study said that the food isn't as healthy as many think. Begging the question, who thinks Chipotle's healthy? And if you do, can I talk to you about buying a bridge? In weather, the rainy day, it'll give way to the first scorcher of 2016. 90 plus degrees tomorrow and Saturday. Darn it, I needed like 3 more weeks for my beach bod. You know what? Just got to go. Balls out. I mean, not literally. In sports, the only thing that could slow down the Cubs? A day off. They get a day of rest and it'll pick back up tomorrow night in Hotlanta. The White Sox welcomed James Shields to the clown show last night. I love the White Sox, but this is getting super ridiculous. After starting strong, the Sox have dropped 20 of 26 games. They're 6-20. They're under 500 now, and they're on the verge of getting swept out tonight by the Nationals at home. The Sox released Matt Latos today and all of his tattoos. That was fast. So two of their starting rotation have been outright released this year. Yikes. Hey, they also signed Justin Morneau, who's currently missing an arm, elbow surgery. He'll contribute in August when it's always fun to watch a Sox game. The only bright spot, the Sox drafted somebody today. So watch out, 2018. There might be a midseason call-up in the works. In the NBA Finals, the Cavs rebounded last night and leveled the Golden State Warriors. The Warriors still have a 2-1 lead in the series, but the Cavs look strong. Even without Kevin Love, who was out with a concussion, game 4 tomorrow night. Game 5 tonight in the Stanley Cup playoffs between the Penguins and the Sharks. Not even looking it up. Pittsburgh is up 3-1. I was right. I'm right. Strong guess. That's just hockey. Every series, a team is up 3-1. And finally, it was reported last night that Justin Bieber got in a fist fight in Cleveland after the NBA Finals. And no word on whether or not the little girl is okay. That's the carryout for June 8th, 2016. Hey, who here ordered the peanut butter pizza? Oh, pepperoni. Sorry, terrible handwriting. Coming up, we're going to talk with famed author R.L. Stine. Next year will be the 25th anniversary of the Goosebumps series. R.L. Stine will be at the Lit Fest this weekend. We'll talk to him here tonight. It's a download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right. Coming up, we will talk with R.L. Stine after the news. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well, my friend. And you?
I'm good. The White Sox get off to an early start here. It looks good. I think it's 3-0 here.
Wow.
Yeah, right? They're beating up on their old buddy Gio Gonzalez. He was a White Sox.
Unfortunately for the White Sox, there are 8 more innings left in this game.
They're having such a run. Hawk Harrelson tonight. He's going to come on a little later.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like the Hawk.
Yeah, we'll talk about the idea that he's too much of a homer.
Well, he is paid by the team, I think,
yeah,
correct?
Right. I was when I was getting ready today, I was reading some stuff, and I guess his call he did against the Royals where the Sox gave up 7 in the 9th a couple weeks ago was like on the verge of tears. Like there was a point where he was like quiet, like he didn't say anything for like like 30 seconds.
You look at a guy like Hawk and those who do play-by-play, and if you're paid by the team, you're basically paid as a, you know, an advocate, as a, you know, PR arm.
Yeah, why
try to hide that? Right, and that's fine. I think Eddie Olczyk has struck a great balance between when he does games here versus when he does games nationally.
NBC,
he does a really good job of it.
No, he's one of the best.
Yeah.
All right, tonight's a big night for you, man. The Penguins, huh?
They're already down. What, they're down 2-1?
Yeah,
in the early
going.
No, it's early. Yeah, we'll get it. We'll get it back. They'll get it back.
They'll get it back. I got the Penguins winning tonight, so get ready.
I hope so.
I have, and as we've been told, Pete and I are not hockey experts. By any stretch, we should keep our mouth shut.
Real quick, an interesting little statistic about Pittsburgh and all of the championships that they've won over the years, Pirates and obviously the Steelers. If the Penguins can clinch it tonight, this will be the first time that a championship has been won in Pittsburgh since the 60s.
Wow. All right. I'm down.
There you go.
I like the Steelers so much, I go for the Penguins, too. Why not?
Yeah, boy.
All right. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this weekend is the Printers Row Lit Fest, one of my favorite festivals of the summer. It's sponsored by the Trib, and it's got several vendors that sell books, and the festival welcomes some great authors and produces live readings and events. But the headliner, if you will, for this year's Lit Fest is arguably one of the biggest authors working today. R.L. Stine is the award-winning author behind the Goosebumps series, which has over 400 million books in print around the world. And it was turned into a television program and, of course, major motion picture starring Jack Black. Next year will be the 25th anniversary of the first book in the children's horror series, Goosebumps. Stine will be on stage at the Harold Washington Library's auditorium Saturday around noon. At that time, Stine will be given the 2016 Chicago Tribune Young Adult Literary Award. But before that, he's here on The Download tonight. R.L. Stine, thanks for taking some time out to talk with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. That was a nice, long introduction. I think you covered everything.
We did, so thanks for joining us. Yeah, exactly. Well, Bob, first let me ask you, what does it mean to you to get this award from the Chicago Tribune?
I'm excited about it. It's so many wonderful authors have received it in the past, and so I'm very pleased and very honored. And I think it's great any time a horror writer gets an award. That doesn't happen too often.
Do you categorize yourself as a horror writer? I mean, obviously, that's what you're...
I don't really. I never really planned to be scary. I always wanted to be funny. And I wrote joke books for kids and a funny magazine for kids. And the honest truth is, it wasn't even my idea for me to be scary. An editor gave me the idea. It's kind of embarrassing. I didn't think of it. So I don't really think of myself as a horror writer. I guess I think of myself mainly as a kid's writer.
Let's get to the early days when you were writing joke books and writing Bananas, which was, I love Bananas, and it's awesome to, when I was going through your bio and seeing that you did Bananas, that was a big childhood favorite of mine. But I'm always wondering for you as a humor writer at that time, because Bananas was really kind of in the Mad Magazine, but with color, as you said. How did you write jokes for kids at that time in the late 70s? Did you hone yourself as a humorist to be able to write jokes for teens and for kids?
Well, I'd been doing it like my whole life. So it wasn't. I started writing when I was 9 years old. I was this weird kid. Brought this typewriter into my room, and I would type little joke books and little funny magazines and type all this stuff. My mother would be outside my door. She'd say, "Go outside and play. What's wrong with you?" I'd say, "It's boring out there." Type, 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 type. So I'd been, that's all I did. That's all I've ever done.
Do you think that helped you be an authentic writer? The way that you started so early, you're 9 years old and you're writing for your peers?
Well, I don't know. It helped me, I guess. I'm lucky I know how to communicate with kids. I think I'm a little strange for a children's author. I actually like kids. Right? I have a kid. I have a grandson now. I like kids. And I know their kids are very smart. I never talk down to them. And I sort of, I spy on them a lot. So I know what they're talking about and what kind of clothes they wear. And I can be, authentic that way.
Let's talk about your transition from humor to horror. When the editor suggested that to you, what did you know about the genre, and as a writer, how did you prepare to be able to write that genre for kids?
Well, I'd always loved horror. My brother and I when we were kids, we went every Saturday, we'd go to a horror movie and we'd see The Creature Walks Among Us or The Brain That Wouldn't Die or Creature from the Black Lagoon. We loved them. I always loved horror. Starting with those great EC horror comics, Tales from the Crypt and The Vault of Horror. That was a very early influence on me. I just never thought about writing it, but I'd always loved it, so it was kind of easy to switch over. And I think humor and horror are very close together. It's kind of the same visceral reaction that the reader gets.
That's a good point. I mean, didn't really think about that. For writing for kids in this regard, when you started with horror and you had all those, you know, the background of going to the movies to see horror, where did you find that balance to not be too scary?
I think the very first Goosebumps book, Welcome to Dead House, I think it's too scary. I hadn't really found the balance. And then I think I got it with the second book, which was called Stay Out of the Basement, about this father who's turning into a plant. He's growing leaves. And I think I kind of got it, and I realized that, you know, I wanted to put a lot of humor in, and I didn't ever want it to get really too intense.
As a humorist, I mean, that's the same question I did for the horror. Do you have to give your humor to a child in a different way than you would, say, a teen or an adult, because they're not going to get irony. They may not be ready for sarcasm. We're
right.
Talking 8, 9 years old.
No,
so how do you do
sarcasm.
That? Yeah, right.
You're right. You're absolutely right. You have to be on their level. Whenever I write, you know, I write a lot of teen. I brought back my teen series, Fear Street. I'm killing off teenagers again. Everyone loves that, right?
You can't kill off the kids and the younger
kids.
You
don't kill off any kids. No one ever dies in Goosebumps.
Right.
But in Fear Street, I mean, it's terrible. Terrible. You know, the kids that are, I picture the readers as I write them. And if I'm doing a younger book for 7 to 12-year-olds, I kind of see these kids in front of me as I'm doing it. And it helps me relate. And if I'm doing teenagers, then I see older kids.
The success of the Goosebumps movie that was just out with Jack Black was tremendous. You know, lines to go see that movie. Talk about your relationship with the character who was the star of that show, which was Slappy. You mentioned it in one of the articles I read about, you know, going for Halloween, you know, like people going as Slappy even to this day.
What a great thing. I couldn't believe all the pictures I got of, like, hundreds of kids going out as Slappy for Halloween this year. It was kind of amazing.
How does that make you feel, the fact that, I mean, Slappy's an older...
really good. Yeah. My grandson was a year and a half, and he went as Slappy, right? Mm-hmm. And I have the Slappy dummy here at home, and we took the clothes off the real Slappy and put them on my grandson. They fit him perfectly. And he went out wearing Slappy's real clothes. We're doing a series because of Slappy's popularity in the Goosebumps movie. We're doing a new Goosebumps series. We change the name quite often now to keep it fresh.
Mm-hmm.
The next four books are called Goosebumps Slappy World. And Slappy actually tells the stories in the next four books that I'm writing.
For that character to take off the way it has, and you've had such memorable characters as part of the Goosebumps series, why do you think that that character resonates over the other villains?
I write him as an insult comic, and he just insults everybody. He's horribly rude, which makes it fun for me to write. And I think kids like that. He's just awful to all the parents, all the adults in the book. He's horrible to everyone. Makes awful jokes about people before he turns really evil.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't quite do that in the movie.
Right.
The movie, he was pretty much straight evil.
Yeah.
You know, I had a few laughs. I would have liked him to have more jokes.
You didn't get a chance to get a rewrite on the script?
I did not.
You mentioned at one point, you know, the idea of having a movie like Goosebumps that was out just last fall. You know, that's a risky move for someone who has a series like Goosebumps. It could be a series killer if the movie doesn't do well.
Tell me about it. No, it's really true. What if the movie was terrible? It could be. And I had, you know, very little control. I mean, I did make comments on the script and, you know, watched over how they treated me as a character. But, it could have been. Look how lucky I am. The movie turned out to be good. And it really helped book sales, like, tripled over Christmas.
Wow.
It was a wonderful thing. And they're talking about doing a sequel now, so I'm happy. I think Jack is signed.
Well, Jack Black plays a reclusive, mysterious author who is misunderstood but, you know, closed off to his neighborhood. But that couldn't be any further from the truth when it comes to the real R.L. Stine.
Well, it's funny. When I met Jack, he flew into New York and we had lunch and talked. And he, you know, I think he came just to look at me, try to figure out what. And he said, Bob, what in the script is true about you? And I said, Jack, not a single thing. There's nothing true about me. He said, I'm going to play a sinister version of you. That's what I'm going to do.
Did you like that? I mean, it's appropriate.
I loved it. He's terrific. He's just a great guy, too.
You know, when you're at the Lit Fest this weekend, there's going to be different generations. You know, you're going to have the people who grew up with Goosebumps, but the kids who have been exposed to the new Goosebumps, but also the movie. How does that make you feel to know that you know, a generation is growing up and exposing your work to their kids?
So I would do a book signing, and I'd get 7-year-olds and 10-year-olds and then 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds. And I'd say, what are you doing here? Say, we loved you when we were kids. And I realize I'm nostalgia to these people, which is a kind of a strange thing to be nostalgia. But, talk about the movie. It worked out perfectly because the adults went to see it for nostalgic reasons, and they brought their kids. I'm delighted. You know, it's just such a nice thing to keep on going. Goosebumps is going into its 25th year.
That's unbelievable.
It is to me, too. That's a lot of stories. What's the next plot, please?
Well, one thing that I want to ask as we wrap up here is just, you know, I'm fascinated with legacy because, you know, any author who's had the success you've had, and there are some authors that have, can be excited and jubilant and rich with both emotion and money based on the fact that they were able to be bestsellers. In your case, Goosebumps becomes required reading and even becomes intertwined with the school districts. I mean, schools have reached out and said that R.L. Stine's work is required reading for our kids. And
you know, we got kids to read is what happened.
That's what I was at. Like,
all these librarians and reading teachers have been so supportive because they saw that kids who didn't read before at all, you know, picked up Goosebumps books and read. And so that's why we've had such support in the schools. And that's what it's all about, really. You know, I don't want to really terrify kids. It's all reading motivation.
And it's when they're first starting to read. That's the beauty of it, right?
6, 7 years old, it's like their first chapter books. So that's fun.
The 2016 Chicago Tribune Young Adult Literary Award goes to R.L. Stine, and he will be at the Harold Washington Library Auditorium this Saturday as part of Printers Lowell.
We'll be talking, and I'll sign everyone's book.
That's great.
It'll be a lot of fun.
Bob, thank you so much for taking some time out
this
to talk to
great.
Us tonight. We appreciate it.
I really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yes, it's a download here on WGN Radio. Justin Kaufman coming up. Scott Frankel's here. Just talked with him. I'm very excited to talk to him. Broadway musical composer. You know, we've had a lot of, you know, we had Kate Baldwin on not too long ago. Mm-hmm. We talked to Robert Falls last week. You know, I don't think we've ever had a composer on. And I remember, I think when we were talking to Kate, that I was like, man, I really want to talk to like a Broadway choreographer and composer, a lyricist, someone who does the book. I'm just fascinated on how you put together a Broadway musical. There's so much that goes into it. And, you know, Scott's one of the best. You talk about experience, and I can't wait to talk to him. But, I mean, you go back into his bio, and he's playing piano in Broadway musicals that are just, you know, iconic.
Yeah.
I mean, he writes his own, and War Paint. He's doing the Goodman Theater's War Paint. He's also going to be at the Lit Fest, so we'll talk with him about that. But, you know, he's the composer on War Paint, which is coming to the Goodman at the end of this month, so
can't wait to see that.
Assistant conductor maybe for Into the Woods, 1987. How great is that, man? So we'll talk. I mean, it's awesome to have him here in Chicago. First and foremost, to have him here in Chicago, and then to have him here on the download. He'll be my guest at the big table coming up at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Anna Castillo, great novelist, poet, playwright. She grew up here in Chicago. Great Mexican-American artist and writer. We'll talk with her. She's going to be at LitFest. And then we'll transfer out of our LitFest coverage with Hawk Harrelson. Talk with him about his illustrious broadcasting career here in Chicago. GQ Magazine called him one of the worst. And I said to GQ, good day. You are done. I will not pick you up at the airport anymore. Vanity Fair, hello. You're out. I can't believe they said that. He's the best. I just, you know, what gets me, and I don't know, I don't think you're a Hawk guy because you're a Cubs guy. But what I love about Hawk Harrelson, I continue to sing his praises, is that we don't have enough broadcasters who bring that kind of flavor, that eccentric flavor.
Right. Everybody's kind of
that's baseball.
Beige.
Yeah. Like everyone got all Joe Buck.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Everyone got very objective and middle of the road, it's ready for baseball. You know, that kind of thing. And if something goes wrong, they go, well, that's an error. If you're Hawk Harrelson, you're like, come on now. What's it? And then, like I said, the game against the Royals where they imploded and gave up 7 runs in the 9th, there was like a stretch of like, it sounded like he was crying. He was quiet, and then he refused to give the score. Like, he wouldn't accept that the game was over. That's what I want out of my broadcast.
Yeah, I'm a Cubs fan, but I don't hate Hawk Harrelson. I can't get angry about broadcasters. I just don't have, you know, I do other things. You know, just
well, other things going on in your life.
I don't want to get mad at another team's broadcaster for. But
it's,
yeah,
it's so zen.
You know, like
it's
I
so
enjoy
zen.
Him when he yells at umpires.
Yeah. Come on now. And coming up at 10 o'clock tonight, live music in studio from John Lankford from the Mekons, the Waco Brothers. His band, the Waco Brothers, is playing at Rib Fest this weekend. John Lankford's unreal. Welsh-born guitarist and drummer who played in the Mekons, one of the most sort of famous punk bands. They came right out in the shadow of the Sex Pistols. He moved to Chicago in the, I think it was the early 90s, and began exploring country music. He became sort of the voice for alt country here in Chicago. So we'll talk with him about his career, and Bethany Thomas will be here to sing as well. So we got a great show tonight here on The Download. I'm very excited about it. So stay with us. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Our friend of the show, Maggie, said that she listened to R.L. Stein with her son. And hilariously, and I didn't even think about this, he also said, thank you so much for putting him on before bedtime. We did a good job there. You know, we could have scheduled Mr. Stein for 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. This show's on till 11. But we were responsible broadcasters. R.L. Stein's audience is going to bed at 8 o'clock.
The Download receives an award for responsible broadcasting. I like that. That's good.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's a little things. I'd like to thank Rob Martier. I'd like to thank Pete Zimmerman. I'd like to thank all the 8-year-olds that listen to the show. So, that's great.
This year's Golden Dome Award for Responsible Broadcasting, Justin Kaufman.
I'm on a fast track to host the Nickelodeon Awards. You know, like I could be that guy who gets slimed. You know, hey, kids. I know what's up with the kids, man. They want to be in bed by 8.
Is he still around, that guy?
Who?
The slime guy.
Yeah.
He's always getting
yeah. They slime people at the Nickelodeon.
All right.
Here we go. All right. Now we're digressing into slime. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Anna Castillo's here, a longtime Chicago poet, novelist, award winner. She's going to be at LitFest as well. We're going to talk about her new memoir, Black Dove. Also coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Hawk Harrelson, the Chicago White Sox play-by-play announcer who only does road games now. He's sort of in half retirement. And we'll decide. He'll let us know if it's working. He told the owner, Jerry Reinsdorf, if he didn't like this part-time gig, he was going to retire. So we're sort of into June. We'll see if he likes it, and we'll talk with Hawk Harrelson about his career coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. But right now, my guest at the big table, you know, it's not every day that you get a Broadway composer up here in the studio. And I've been looking for one. Scott Frankel is one of the best. He worked in musicals for years. He was nominated for a Tony for his work on Grey Gardens. He's in Chicago to premiere his newest work. He wrote the music for the new Goodman Theater production of War Paint, starring Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole. Scott's done it all. He's been a musical director, a pianist, a conductor, and he's going to be at the Lit Fest this weekend at the Hotel Blake, Saturday at 12:30 p.m. It's a panel discussion about War Paint, moderated by the Tribune's Chris Jones. War Paint, of course, starts at the end of the month. Scott Frankel, thanks for being here.
Hey, Justin. Happy to be here. That half-retirement thing is sounding pretty good to me about now.
Just road games,
right? Just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, let's talk about War Paint. This is a highly anticipated musical here
in
Chicago. We've been talking about
it
forever.
World premiere at the Goodman. So happy to be here. We've been in rehearsals, and the show's about two cosmetics titans in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden. And they famously hated each other.
Right.
And this incredible rivalry and competition we kind of explore through song and dance and text and all of the good stuff with two amazing actresses, Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole.
You mentioned that you're in rehearsals. When is the rehearsal process for a Broadway musical like this that's going to start a world premiere in Chicago? When does the rehearsal process start?
We did about 3 weeks of rehearsal in New York, and we came to Chicago on Monday. So it'll be about 4.5 weeks of rehearsals in a rehearsal room with props and scenery, and then we move downstairs to the theater for costumes and lights and orchestra and all of those
the fun stuff.
Exciting elements.
When you're deciding to do a musical on something that's about cosmetics, where do you even start with that? Because you're not basing it on it. This is actually off a story, a book. But talk about how do you put the music together? Is it sort of the idea of, oh, this would be, let's go salsa. I think salsa would be great. Like, how do you bring the music out in a production like this?
Absolutely. Well, Rubinstein was a Polish emigre. So she was short and had Central European accent. So some of that appears in her musical language. Arden was from Canada. And was much more of a kind of prim and proper, you would say a Ralph Lauren type now, elegant and kind of the horsey set.
So you're actually using that background, pulling out research on these people to figure out what the musical language is going to be.
Absolutely. And Rubinstein as a Jewish European has a certain sound, and Arden is a kind of, horsey, elegant, wasp aspiring lady, has a different kind of sound as well. But also it's a treat to, because we travel from different decades, 30s, 40s, 50s,
right,
and 60s, to kind of play with the sound. And when we get to the 1950s, there's a wonderful production number in Act Two called Fire and Ice, and which was a huge Revlon campaign. And Revlon and Charles Revson features it into the plot of the show. And there's a great Bongolicious. That's the tempo marking on that song. It says Bongolicious, and it's a big production number, as if on with all the 50s colors you could ask for.
Well, I mean, is that as a composer, when you're inspired by a text or you're inspired by a story, is that really what you're looking for? You're looking for decades, then what kind of music was happening then? You're doing a little bit research on the characters, where they're from?
Yeah, I think that there's that. And there's also, when you look at a musical or a story or something to develop, people usually say, do the characters sing? Do you want to hear interior thoughts and hopes and feelings and emotions from these characters? And I think with these two ladies, you really do. Not only about how they feel about each other, but about how they feel about themselves. And the other thing I should mention is that, they were both CEOs of their corporations that bore their name at a time when it was a total men's club. I mean, it was them and Henry Ford. That was the male equivalent. They were as big as that, and they were women. And so the piece also examines what it's like to be a woman executive in a man's world and what it's like competing with a woman in a man's world.
What drew you to this project?
I wish I could say that I had lots of experience with mascara and eyeliner personally, but I don't. No, it seemed like it could have, different colors. It could be entertaining. It could be provocative. It could talk about women's, I think, complicated relationship that they have with makeup and cosmetics. I mean, I think that's the part that resonates today for me, that notion of, can I go out of the apartment without my face on? And a lot of women say yes, and a lot of women say no. And what does that mean? And what's the legacy of Rubenstein and Arden? Because they were the first in some ways to suggest the consumer culture of you have to have the latest lipstick and blush and rouge and lotion. And if you don't, you won't be happy. You won't find a man. You'll die alone and impoverished.
So there's a – there's a lot that goes into a musical like this, not just the music, but when you are talking about stories of women in a man's world, you're talking about sort of these kind of clashing concepts of beauty and what's the expectations. So there's a lot that goes into it. Does that also attract you in the sense that there's a lot of sort of ripe storylines and conflict that you can work off as a musician?
Very much so. And, you know, it's dealing with people who really lived, actual historical figures. There's amazing material from biographies of them and their life stories. There's also the inevitable dramatic license that the authors of the musical, sure, myself included, will take, mostly in terms of about compressing events. Rubenstein lived to be in her early 90s and Arden well into her 80s. So in 2 hours and 25 minutes, that's a lot of ground to cover. So we're not doing all 90 years of the life.
30s out, 40s out. Right. Get rid of them. Right.
So yeah. we have compressed certain things, but not. It's essentially true.
Scott Frankel is the composer of War Paint, which is going to be up at the Goodman Theater, the world premiere, which is June 28th. It's also going to be at Litfest tomorrow at the Hotel Blake, or Saturday at the Hotel Blake at 12:30. It's a panel discussion about War Paint, moderated by Tribune's Chris Jones. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more with Scott Frankel here on The Download. Stay with us. It's not every day you get a Broadway musical composer in studio. You have a problem with the Cars for Kids
jingle.
Yeah,
I thought it was just on the East Coast, but I'm so terrified / thrilled to be hearing it here as well. So when you set text to music, you want it to sound, you know, like we would talk in real life. But in the Cars for Kids jingle, and let me be the first to say, I'm sure it's an excellent and very worthy organization.
Sure.
Presumably.
We're not talking about the organization. We're talking about the jingle.
But they go, donate your cars today. And you don't say donate. It's donate.
Right.
Donate your cars today.
You call them up, say, hey, listen, have you seen Grey Gardens?
Yeah, I mean, you need me desperately, Cars for Kids. I might even do it for free.
How about Cars the Kids, a musical?
Great idea.
Let's not give them away.
These are gold, Justin. You might want to claim some proprietary rights to this conversation.
Scott Frankel's in studio with me. He is the composer of the new world premiere, War Paint, the show, the musical that's going to be at the Goodman Theater starting on June 28th.
I feel I should mention my incredibly talented collaborators,
sure,
Michael Corey, the lyricist, and Doug Wright, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. And we're reunited with our Grey Gardens director, Michael Greif, who directed Rent.
It's a small world, Broadway. But how great is it when you get a chance to work with some of the people you've worked with on projects before?
Totally amazing. We've been looking for something to reunite us And this is an auspicious and happy occasion, and to be reunited with Christine Ebersole, who starred and won a Tony Award for her performance in Grey Gardens. So that's happy as well. I've known Patty for a gazillion years. And the thing about what's so amazing for a composer is these are two phenomenal voices, beyond them being incredibly smart, talented actresses.
Do you write with voices in mind?
Absolutely. And again, since we pretty much knew that these two ladies, they were always on our, you know, number one dream list for this project. So when I'm home writing, I'm imagining them singing it. There's a huge gap, by the way, between me singing it at the piano and how it's actually going to sound on stage at the Goodman Theater beginning on July. No, June 28th. June 28th is coming up soon.
It is. It's coming up soon.
Yikes. So these are both phenomenal singing actresses, and what a treat for me to give each of them hopefully their best ammunition in the war and let them duke it out while I go home to New York.
Scott, let's talk about your career, because as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I mean, you were assistant conductor on Into the Woods, and that was a 1987 credit. How did you start in Broadway?
I was young. I was young once, Justin, you know, like you are. I mean, maybe even younger. I went to Yale. I majored in music, and I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. So it was Ohio to Connecticut, and then from Connecticut, I got on the Interstate 95, and I went to New York, and I just started, you know, playing in the pits of Broadway shows or asking around or playing rehearsals. And it led me to some amazing places. I worked on the original production of Les Mis as a pianist and to Sondheim for Into the Woods, as you mentioned. And that was incredible for a 23-year-old.
Is that the way that a career in Broadway is going to go for a composer? I mean, you start in the pits, you start playing piano, you start doing things that are just components of the music?
I think a lot of, you know, Marvin Hamlisch started out as a rehearsal pianist. And, you know, I think a lot of... John Kander was a rehearsal pianist of Kander and Ebuhur Cabaret in Chicago. So, yeah, it's a kind of great way to be a fly on the wall with some great directors and stars and to see how shows are put together. And
What did you learn as a 23-year-old in the pit playing, as looking back on it as a composer, what did that experience teach you that helps you write musicals today?
You know, one thing was amazing watching Stephen Sondheim, that in rehearsal, he would always have this, have a pad, and there would be no kind of artistic temper, but there was no yelling, there was no, you're doing it wrong. He would just very calmly write things down, and then he would go over with the actor or the conductor or whoever he had notes for, but it was so kind of precise and specific. I was always taken by that it was... There were no plates were flying through the air. It was all very reasonable.
And so you take that with you?
Well, no, I'm a monster in rehearsal. I've gone the other direction.
That's not what I'm going to do, Stephen.
Wait. Oh, did I just say that? I should also mention that my college classmate Tina Landau is directing the
SpongeBob,
world.
Yeah,
SpongeBob right up the street. It's like Yale reunion week in town.
That plays back to the idea that Broadway is a pretty small community, even though there's a ton of artists and musicians and composers and playwrights. You end up working and knowing a lot of people, and that's really how you get your next project.
I think it's wonderful to work with new people, and it's also great to you know, be reunited with people you knew as teenagers, for God's sakes. I mean, we took it really seriously. I remember that. Like, now, it was like it was life and death looking back, like, oh my God, do you have the rewrites for tomorrow? Do you have the rewrites? Are you going to be in time for rehearsal? I was like, how devastating could it have been if you were late for rehearsal as a 20-year-old junior at Yale? I mean, it's not like you're going to, you know. Well, time.
Yeah,
distance.
But I was going to say time is
time, and of course a long stay in the state penitentiary for me as well, which gave me a lot of time to reflect.
That's where all the tattoos are from.
Totally, you know, and it's weird because being Jewish, I'm not supposed to get tattoos because of the religious prescription. But I've gone another direction, like, you know, again, like the Sondheim anecdote. You know, he's measured and thoughtful, and I just yell and scream.
From your experiences with all the composers that you worked with, when you were a conductor, when you were a pianist, when you were in the pit. Has that helped you define a sound for as a writer, as a composer? I mean, is it like being a musician, a pop musician, where you have a certain distinct sound that you bring to the musicals?
It's a really interesting question. In a way, yes, but in a way, I almost look back to their influences. So, like stuff in classical music or stuff in pop music, it all kind of trickles down and then ends up in the. I'm going to mix my metaphors, and then ends up in the Cuisinart in my head, and I don't. Consciously ape any of them, but I think the influences from everyone from, you know, ELO to Mozart, you know, I mean, and everything in between. I mean, I have a pretty eclectic taste in music. And
is there a kind of music that you'll stay away from that you're like, as a composer, that I know I have limitations in that music?
You know, well, more on the listening level, like sometimes the Celtic stuff on NPR, like the, you know, like those flutes, like, it's like, seriously, you guys, it's like, come on. Or like the accent in the Celtic. I mean, well, I'm sure. Well, yes.
The Thistle and Shamrock.
I'm not going to be doing the whole Riverdance 2 musical.
I'm going to hold you to that. When Riverdance 2 comes out and it's like.
They're also not calling me for that. So
Scott Frankel.
Never say never. I would love to write Riverdance 3, however. By then, I will have worked my way up to it in my head.
Scott Frankel is a composer. He is the composer behind the new musical War Paint, which is going to be at the Goodman Theater starting on June 28th, world premiere Broadway musical. We'll continue the conversation. You're going to be at the Lit Fest this weekend, Saturday at 12:30 at the Hotel Blake. Panel discussion moderated by the Tribs' Chris Jones. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. I'd love to talk to you just about the process of putting a musical together. This musical and others you've worked on, rehearsals, all the stuff that goes into it. There's a lot of people that just don't know about what happens behind the scenes before it even hits the stage.
First thing you need is the prescription medication.
There it is. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Broadway composer Scott Frankel. He's the man behind the music. The new Goodman Show, War Paint, starts on June 28th. He's going to be at the Lit Fest this weekend, a panel discussion moderated by the Chicago Tribune's Chris Jones. Saturday at 12:30 at the Hotel Blake, which you just told me is haunted.
That's what I hear. I can't get confirmation on that, but if you do Wikipedia on the Hotel Blake, that's the first thing that comes up. So if I don't come back from the Lit Fest, you'll know there was a problem.
You get to go see a great conversation about war paint, and you get to be in a haunted hotel.
Yeah. Ectoplasm.
That's kind of great. That's all the rage these days.
Yeah.
All right, so we're talking about war paint, but we're also talking about your career in Broadway musicals. One of the things I never knew, and as I had more conversations with Broadway artists, you find out that there's a whole ecosystem behind the Broadway musical before it even gets to the stage, and sometimes without the stage. And that's the rehearsal process for projects and other productions that composers like yourself are working on.
Yeah,
Explain that.
You know, you get an idea for something, and you work on it for years and years and years, and then it's in your head, and then it's on the page, and then you've written some tunes for it. And then, you know, if you're lucky, maybe you get some actors to read it in a rehearsal room. And then if you're really, really lucky, like I am, you get to see it at this incredible theater in Chicago for a world premiere. There are 800,000 people in that theater right now, hanging lights and building sets and designing costumes and working on makeup and transitions. And there's a guy in the basement writing out orchestra parts, and there's going to be a band in there. And to see all those components put together, I mean, that's one of the great things about live theater. It's real time. It's not pre-recorded. No one's lip syncing. It's all happening, and it's all these jigsaw puzzle pieces put together. And it's an incredible privilege. And they say it's the uniquely American art form that to sing and to dance and to act and to have it live on stage is what we bring to the culture.
How many productions do you or projects do you think? Let me just ask it this way. I mean, how many times have you come up with that idea in your head and it hasn't made it to the Broadway stage?
Much more than have.
Right. But that's interesting. I mean, you have credits are unbelievable Broadway credits for being involved in, whether it be In the Pit or composing Grey Gardens or Far From Heaven. You were involved in that. I mean,
there was just a production here this year, so which I unfortunately didn't get a chance to see. But yeah,
you had successes, and for all those successes as a Broadway composer, there are still a lot that didn't get off the ground.
Absolutely. I've had certainly my share of heartaches, and I think you can see it in my face, Justin. I'm not tearing up, but I think you can see the lines. No, it's
one single tear.
I mean, you have to, you know, unless you want it done in your living room, you have to hustle and work and be patient and just hope for a lot of luck.
Is there one project that you think of that you're like, that was my passion play? That was what I loved, and it didn't get past the rehearsals.
No, actually it did, and that was Grey Gardens.
Really?
Yeah.
So talk about that, because that was a documentary.
Right. I mean, so it's this documentary film by the great Albert and David Maisels, the Maisels brothers, and it was about an aunt and a first cousin of Jackie Kennedy, and they were both named Edith, Big Edith and Little Edith, and they lived together in this decrepit mansion in East Hampton called Grey Gardens. And, you know, up until that point, a documentary had never been turned into a musical. And I had this crazy idea. I thought, well, maybe it could be a musical. I mean, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but maybe it could be. And so I then started to go out and get the rights and try to convince everybody that I wasn't
insane.
Dude,
did people, I mean, that because it was a new experience in Grey Gardens, taking a documentary,
right,
were people reticent? Were they like,
Oh, everyone thought I was crazy. I mean, and I won't dispute that in any way, because that would just be a lie. But you know, I think those artist-driven projects, the ones you have a passionate vision, and other people, you know, it's like a Tesla kind of thing. It's like, I see this, but the possibility of this crazy battery-driven car, and you all may think I'm crazy, but you know, I think those are the good ideas, the ones that are unlikely.
Well, I mean, we've seen in Broadway musicals, just even currently. I mean, I think of the inspirations for Broadway musicals are wide-ranging. I mean, I think Rock of Ages and things like that.
Totally. Where it's like, there are some that can be like amazing pop catalogs of the Beatles or of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, like in Jersey Boys. Or then there are some that are taken from books, and there are some that are taken from movies. And then there are are some that are based on cosmetics executives from the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
What I'm interested is both, I mean, Grey Gardens and Far From Heaven was a movie before it was a musical. When you're adapting or taking something from another medium,
mm-hmm.
how do you keep from sort of having your visions and your images be duplicative of what was in the movie?
It's a really good question. But because the different mediums are so have their own sweet spots. For instance, I'll give you an example. Like in a movie, when a camera goes super close on an actor's face and there's no dialogue, and maybe there's just some scoring, or maybe there isn't, but you can see what the actor is thinking, and that's all silent. You can if they're elated, if they're pensive, if they're whatever they're feeling. In a musical, that's a great time for someone to sing. Okay. So that would be like a because you can't do a close up. You're 100 feet back in the audience. If you could,
so essentially, close ups are songs.
Ours can become soliloquies. Can become a way for characters to express what's inside of themselves. So that's a great. When the camera pans back, like in The Sound of Music, when there's the Swiss Alps and she's there doing, you know, that. That's a helicopter shot. Like, that's hard to do in the theater. So so you got to find another way to do that.
Right. Unless you're Spider-Man, right?
That's many more millions than I have. And
that's not in the budget for war paint,
shot? I have to say, Goodman Theater is an amazing, luxurious place to work. But it is still an institutional theater, which is to say, not a commercial theater.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, you've been involved with so many different projects, and we talked about Into the Woods, Les Mis, Grey Gardens, this war paint show that's coming up. Are you at a point in your career where you can pick the kind of projects that you want to be involved in, or are you still, like many other Broadway artists, just kind of like, I'm going to jump in and I hope people like this?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I wish I could say that the phone was ringing all the time with exciting offers, but it's not really true. So...
Is that just indicative of the business?
I think so. And I think also, you know, I think it, in a way it's good because it inspires people like me to really look inside or look under rocks and think, well, no one's thought of this, but maybe this could work. And again, that kind of singular passion for something sometimes leads to an exciting project. And sometimes the other ones that are maybe a little bit more expected are maybe a little less exciting.
The shows that right now on Broadway, I think of even people who are listening right now to WGN Radio, maybe in Chicago aren't familiar with Broadway, but they get a feel for it when you have these sort of rising, you know, huge successes like Hamilton.
Yeah, you're gonna get Hamilton.
Yeah,
like
we
this
are.
Fall.
That's right.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So, but what makes it amazing from a composer standpoint? What I'm saying is, like, you are inside. What makes that show better than other shows that are on Broadway?
It's super singular. The way that the composer takes contemporary music, not just rap, but kind of R&B too, and you have these historical 18th century characters that are speaking and singing in this incredibly contemporary vernacular, and that's super exciting juxtaposition. It's not ye olde music playing, or not like fife and drum kind of thing.
Right,
it's hot and electric, and still. You get the history and you get the period, and there were the founding fathers. It was right when I was in high school, when the country was founded in the late 1700s.
Right. That was a good time.
Yeah,
it was strong.
Totally,
I remember seeing you with the flute and the drum.
I did. Well, I had just been rejected from the Cars for Kids jingle competition, so I was a little dejected.
I'll come up with a composition for this battle, for this war.
It'll be a little military.
Right. All right, so. For you, this process right now that we're in, where you're in rehearsals and you talked about all the people that are at the theater right now, hundreds of people putting lights.
That's true.
Is this the sweet spot for you as a composer, or is it back in your living room when you're on your piano coming up with the music?
They're both incredibly satisfying in a way. One is more, you know, imagination from nothing, and this is to see your house built from the blueprint in your head. And that's incredibly exciting too. We also make tons of changes every day in the script and the music. Maybe this note is too long.
Really?
Maybe somebody can't hit this note, and so I need to make a different note. Maybe something feels long. Maybe something feels short. And I think also in previews, you know, we start June 28th. We open in the middle of July, and we run through August 14th. So we're going to keep working on it. there's this adage that you never finish musicals, you just open them. So,
and there's a plan with the Goodman Theater for this to be a world premiere here in Chicago, but to hit Broadway shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, there are no specific plans, but that's certainly everyone's. I would be lying if I didn't say that was everybody's dream, certainly my dream, to show to have the biggest life possible, and that's usually the gold standard.
Okay, so what, for you and your career, and you've had such a great career writing music.
I got to come
musicals.
Back more often because it sounds so much better when you talk about that. When I think about it at home, I'm like, damn, I didn't get
that
job.
It's the internet. That's the internet that's telling me you had a great career.
Oh, okay,
right?
Fair enough.
So there you go. So, no, yeah, a lot of people have said that. But, you know, I guess what's the dream? I mean, is the dream to be have a show like Hamilton? Is the dream as a composer to win a Tony? And what is the end game for a composer on Broadway?
I think those are great, but I have to say, so, like, there have been amazing productions of Grey Gardens that I've seen, like, in Rio and in Tokyo, and until you've seen Jackie Kennedy's relatives, you see the set in East Hampton, and they open their mouths, and they're speaking and singing in Japanese, and you're like, wow, was the jet lag that bad? But, you know, to see your work live on without you being involved, that to me is an incredible, that's what I treasure. That you know, they'll do it in high schools, they do it, it'll touch someone, it'll resonate for someone long after I'm gone, at least I hope so.
Scott Frankel is the composer of the new show War Paint, which is at the Goodman Theater. Previews start June 28th. It's running through August 14th.
That's, I'm going to say goodmantheater.org, and I think there are still some tickets available.
There you go.
All of that.
It's War Paint. It's starring Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole. It's a world premiere Broadway musical here at the Goodman Theater this summer. You can also check out the Lit Fest this weekend, the Printer's Row Lit Fest at the Hotel Blake, the Haunted Hotel Blake. Saturday at 12:30, a panel discussion about War Paint, moderated by Tribbs. Chris Jones, Scott will be there. Scott Frankel, thanks for being my guest tonight.
Thank you. And if you come to the theater, I'll be the guy pacing nervously in the back.
Right, it's Download here on WGN Radio. That was great, man. I really like that guy. He's very, very good chemistry in the sense that he's quick on his feet. The Cars for Kids stuff was great.
Yes.
You could do a musical on Cars for Kids.
Can't wait to see that.
And it also blows my mind that Cars for Kids is also annoying people on the East Coast, too. It's like... All right. Someone is giving me junk about my use of the word duplicative. Duplicative.
Duplicative?
Yeah, right? What did I say? Duplicative?
I think you said it great, right?
Yeah. I said it wrong. It's live radio. You know, I was trying to say, how do you not do the same thing as the movie? Duplicative.
Yeah, I think you said it right. Maybe I think the texter is impressed by your vocabulary.
Oh, I thought they were making fun of me.
No. I think that was a positive.
I would have made fun of me. I'd have been like, why are you using that word?
It was a good word.
Come on, jerk off. all right, so coming up on the show tonight, I'm excited. Man, this show's going to – I'm feeling good. Keep that energy up. I'm going to have another one of those Wild Burgers. It's been out there since like 6:30. So they are – the Wild Burgers at Taste of Des Plaines. We're going out to test Taste of Des Plaines on the 17th of June. It's next Friday. They brought some burgers over. And there's still some stuff out there. So I think in the break I might go nosh before Anna Castillo.
Yeah, good.
Anna Castillo coming up, which I'm super excited about her too. I loved her work. She got a new memoir out. She's a great poet. And she had done stuff at my old job. And I remember it. And I always was impressed by her poems, and so to have her on, she's a award-winning poet. I don't even think she lives in Chicago anymore, but Chicagoan who grew up here, Mexican-American. She's one of the leading voices in Chicana lit. So we're gonna talk with her coming up. She's also at the Lit Fest coming up this weekend, and then Hawk Harrelson
also at the Lit Fest this weekend. No, he's not, probably.
That'd be awesome. He did write a book. He wrote a book. I read this that, and maybe I'll ask him about it. He wrote a book where something about when he was in Cleveland. He played in Cleveland in the 60s. And he wrote a book that's something like The Roaring 60s, The Fast Flying Indians and How Great They Were, or something like that, like a book you would write for Cleveland. It's like, oh, the 60s baseball, the Cleveland Indians. Like, it was that kind of thing. Because he played – I didn't know this about Hawk, but I knew he played baseball, but he was on the A's, and he got bounced. He got traded, I think fired, because they fired the coach. And he said to the newspaper about Charlie Finley at the time, you know, this guy's a no good bum. Like, he's mm-hmm. like the owner's a no good bum. And so the owner, this is a different time. This is not, you know, now where there's PR and all this kind of, the owner's just like, all right, then you're gone. So he got traded and he went to play somewhere else. All right. So now everybody in the text is just ripping on me about the pronunciation. But yeah, he went to play somewhere else. Then he ended up in Boston, I think it was. He went to the Game 7 in the 1968 World Series. They lost. Then he was shipped to Cleveland. That's where he wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on and on. So we'll talk with him. And then at 10 o'clock, John Langford.
What a show.
What a show, man. I'm so jacked up. So you get these great guests like Scott. That was great. R.L. Stein was great. We'll keep it going. No, 847 says duplicative.
Duplicative.
What was I saying? Duplicative?
Yeah, and I think that's what I said as well.
Well, are they giving you a hard time about the pronunciation?
Yes, yes.
Duplicative. It's an adjective.
Yeah, what did I say? I must have said it in a way that was, I put the emphasis somewhere else, like duplicative. Duplicative.
Oh. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they're gonna get nitpicky, I do that all the time. Just listen to one of my updates.
No, you know what? I think they're right. I'll never use a word that's more than two syllables. I'm done. I shouldn't have done that. That was a lot. That was a reach. I was feeling it. I was in the zone.
Yeah.
It's like a pitcher going, you know what? I haven't figured out this knuckleball yet, but I'm going to use it.
I don't know. I'm sitting back here behind the wall here thinking, wow, that is an man. I'm it's impressed impressive. By. Yeah. Little did I know.
Next thing you know, I'm just going to be slipping in really big. I should be. That's like Chris Roebling's taught me from Touche. He throws in some great big words on Monday nights. Yeah, anyway, so coming up, great. We're at the halfway point here. Anna Castillo coming up after the break. Stay with us. It's the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, Ken Hawk Harrelson, the play-by-play announcer for the Chicago White Sox, will join us to talk about his career in the broadcast booth. He's gone part-time this year. He only goes on road trips, does not do the home games because he lives in Indiana, and he just doesn't want to take the trip. So the big question is this the last hurrah for Hawk Harrelson? We'll talk with him about his career and plans for retirement coming up after 9:30. But right now we continue our celebration of the Printers Row Lit Fest with my next guest, Chicago poet and author Anna Castillo. Anna's a tremendous poet, essayist, activist. She's also a playwright, and her latest memoir is called Black Dove, Mama, Mijo, and Me. Anna Castillo is one of the leading voices in Chicana literature. She's won all sorts of awards for her work, including the Carl Sandburg Award, and the fact that I love that she has two books banned in Arizona. She will be at the Printers Row Lit Fest on Saturday at 10 a.m. in conversation with Chicago Tribune reporter Darlene Glanton. She'll also be tomorrow night. She's going to be at the Hilton Asmus Gallery at 760 North Wells for a book party and a poetry reading with some of Chicago's great poets. And she's my guest tonight at the Download. Anna Castillo, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
I'm a big fan of your work, and it's great to have you in studio. Let's talk about Black Dove. This is really a memoir about it's a memoir about your life, but it's almost like a genealogy project about your family.
Well, it's a combination of essays, memoir essays, and I think some fall into personal essay that were written over a period of 20 years. The subtitle of the book is Mama, Mijo, and Me. Mijo means my son. It's an affectionate term that Mexicans like to use. We shorten up my son and say Mijo or Mijito, which is how I address my son. And there are essays in the book that I wrote at different stages of his life, in fact, which we kept in the present. Mama is in there, mostly in the past. Unfortunately, she passed away about 20 years ago. But the leading essay in the book is an essay that I wrote while she was still alive. Mm-hmm. She lived in Chicago for over 40 years. And I was telling her story, and you're correct. I was telling her story with her mom and how she got back to Mexico. And
it really is. It's a great story. And it's a well-known story that's not told as much about Mexicans immigrating to America. Talk about that, because you sort of trace back your family coming from Mexico, including your mom, who had to go through a lot of hardships to bring you guys to Chicago.
Yeah, one reviewer said that it was sort of like being also a historian. And the reason for that, there's a sort of a tone in there in the beginning and at the end. The reason for that was 2 years ago, I was invited by Dominican University in River Forest to come and be in residence as an endowed chair for a semester. And one of the assignments or tasks that I had was to do a keynote address to the campus on the subject of immigration. And they work a lot with, not work a lot, they have a lot of students who are Latino and numerous who are undocumented. So in my usual fashion, I can't ever give a short answer to anything. What happened was, when I went to address what's going on now in terms of immigration, I went all the way to the beginning of immigration, European immigration, Asian immigration into the U.S., and that's why it has sort of that tone. And in the process of that, of course, I was weaving in my own family story.
Your mother, you know, I kind of mentioned at the end the hardships. I mean, to be able to come to this country and then talk about getting to Chicago. And that's really part of the essay that you talk about your mom, is about getting here. But it took a while to get here.
Well, I think what's important for me to talk about with regards to my mother's identity is my mother was three-quarters indigenous. She looked very indigenous. I take after her quite a bit. She had a very stoic, very quiet character. Her personality was like that. She never spoke English. 40 years in Chicago, I didn't know my mother spoke English. I don't know how. I thought she was managing. She worked in factories all the decades she was here. She sold Avon for over 40 years. So I don't know what
she didn't speak English.
And she didn't speak English. She didn't speak English to me. I found out sort of by fluke that she understood. I don't know what I was thinking. But that was her identity. And the reason why that's so fascinating to me is because, as a matter of fact, my mother was born in Omaha, Nebraska in the late 20s. Her parents had migrated here, as many workers did. This was a big railroad boom mm-hmm. in the U.S. and Mexico, and my grandfather was an engineer, and so he came here with his young wife, and they had a very lovely life and existence in the Midwest. And many, many people were recruited to come here and help with the railroad and with other things that were going on. In 1929, with the stock market crash, what we estimate unofficially, because it's not documented entirely, big surprise, is that maybe up to 1 million Mexicans and their American-born children were deported. Some were given tickets on those same trains going back. Some were threatened, and others were stuffed into cattle cars. I'm not sure what the story was with my mother and her parents, but this is how she ends up being right. raised in Mexico. And so
sort of like a
repatriation. Yeah, she's going unwillingly. She was deported from her own country. She was we can argue about this as much as we want, but when you think about communities coming, you say, well, you come and you work hard and you establish yourself, and you too can have a piece of the pie. And I have photographs of my grandparents with their Studebaker, and my grandmother with her beautiful pearls, and my grandfather with his gold pocket watch. And to think that they were deported abruptly that way because of what was going on at that time, which is part of the history with Mexican labor. So I wove that into my own family story, which was very fascinating, because how my mother comes back here is actually she just came because she was an American citizen.
Yeah, right.
But nobody knew that to see She was comfortable because she was an American.
She's proud of that. She's living in Mexico. She's not. I mean, I think there's always a I don't know if it's a stereotype, but it seems to be a storyline that's pushed that Mexicans are looking to leave. They want to get to America as fast as they can because America is a land of the opportunity. But to hear your family's story and talk about your mom, who had American citizenship, she was okay in Mexico.
She was brought, in fact, across the border by her grandparents. What happened was when they were deported, both of her parents died very shortly thereafter. I have a guess that it may have been tuberculosis because that was prevalent during that time, and there was apparently no remedy for either one of them. So she was orphaned and began to work as a child. So they were left in poverty with her indigenous grandfather. And so they went to the border and crossed over their grandchildren, who were by that point, they were teenagers, mm-hmm. so they could start working because they were American citizens.
Right.
She ended up in the Midwest coming here with some cousins that were, you know, had heard that there was work here.
Anna, how much of this story was passed down from your family and how much did you have to research it and find different elements of it that wasn't told to you as a kid, even as an adult?
Everything about my mother's story, she told me in over a lifetime. The repatriations I learned when I was in college, and when I learned it, it would just blew my mind because I knew that was my grandparents' story. She didn't have that language. She didn't say that is what was happening in the big picture. She would have said something in Spanish like, they sent us to Mexico and then my father died or something. But to find out that this was a real deliberate move on the part of the U.S. government and how much that had affected my mother's life really, really impacted me in my early 20s when I was beginning to think of myself, amongst other things, perhaps a school teacher, what am I going to do, be a sociologist, as a poet. And so where that information ends up going, it goes into my verses and in my stories.
Talking with Anna Castillo, her new memoir is called Black Dove, Mama, Mijo, and Me. She's a poet, essayist, activist, Chicago born, and also Chicago raised. I mean, I would say you're still a Chicagoan, but
yes.
You spend a lot of your time in New Mexico. You kind of go back and forth. And to write, which I find so interesting, and I want to ask you about the process of writing. I mean, for you to put this together, to put Black Dove together, you go away. What's your process like going away to New Mexico for a writer's retreat?
I found a place in southern New Mexico in the Chihuahuan Desert. I'm not in the cool place in Santa Fe with all the cool artists. I'm up there with Georgia O'Keeffe descendants with the Maple Dodge Lodge and Taos. Where I live is where, you know, amongst the people, the few people that are out there, in a very desert, isolated area. There can be, you know, a week or 2 weeks where I really won't see another person, as a matter of fact.
Is that hard for you as a Chicagoan? Is it someone who grew up here in town where it's a dense, experience?
It's a wonderful balance for me to be here. At the same time, there are times, I talk about this in Black Dove, that I think that aside from having the poet's nature that, you know, that it's quiet, that it needs time by yourself and withdraws, and the writer's nature tends to be like that, solitary. Aside from having that, I talk about my growing up in Chicago and how it was in my home and how I think that there's a part of me that is, I wouldn't say antisocial, but doesn't really have a need for people all the time. Mm-hmm. And then there will come a time in which I'm really like tired of hearing people, the people upstairs or next door or outside. And so it's a wonderful break for me because I'm very comfortable by myself. Strangely enough, I can keep myself busy, not just writing, but just doing things on my own for long periods of time. I also paint. That was my first love. And so that's a nice place to be. But then I realize there comes a moment in which I look around and wonder, where is everybody?
Where did everybody go?
Where did everybody go? And I have to come here.
Let's get back to Chicago.
Yes, and so here I am.
Anna, I mentioned in the intro that you are one of the leading voices in Chicana literature. What does that mean? For someone who's listening to WGN Radio, doesn't know what Chicana literature is, what is that?
Well, we accept that those of us who, at least of my generation, that began to write, who were of Mexican background. We or descended from Mexican. We don't have to be first generation or second generation, just have Mexican background. But we also accepted it as sort of a political strategy to say, I'm not Mexican. I'm not from Mexico. I'm from here with this cultural background. We also, most of us have Spanish last names. When I was a young woman wanting to write, wanting to get into literature and went to these wonderful bookstores that we have here in Chicago, I very rarely found anyone with a Spanish last name unless she was in translation or he was in translation, like the Latin American boom writers. Those were some of the first people I began to read and could identify with as a Latina. But again, here I am in Chicago. This is a very diverse city. Back then, it was very segregated, so I was very conscious of other cultures and the division of races and so on. So we start to bring this together into a new aspect of American literature, and that's what Chicano and Chicana literature became.
A lot of your work centers around identity. This is just trying to find, you know, not just, you know, from your vantage point of what identity, but find a place. I mean, there's a lot of your poetry is about that. You've lived a life where you've been able to identify as Mexican-American. You've identified as a bisexual. You've identified as, as a writer, as an activist, as a player. Even your artistic disciplines are very varied. Talk about why you've centered your work around the concept of identity.
When you are marginalized by dominant society, we have still this idea that the United States is white. Maybe it is white in terms of who holds the power, but at the same time, when we look around, we see a great diversity in most places. But when you grow up in an atmosphere in which you're marginalized for the color of your skin, you're marginalized because of your cultural background, because of your gender, and your sexuality isn't mainstream, you know, nothing is following the norm of the dictates of our society. You can become invisible, you can get depressed, you can just hide, you can go into denial and try to live a different life.
Or you can express yourself, right?
Or you can go ahead and assert that. And so in my early years, we used to say, Sandra Cisneros was also from Chicago, and myself, and you know, we're all over the country, and we'd read together here and other places, and people would label and say they're in search of their identity, or two Chicanas, you know. And we would find that sort of funny. We're not certain, we know what our identity is. What we were doing was defining it or asserting it. This is who we are, in case you're wondering, or before you ask, this is where we come from. To say we were from Chicago was not enough. They would still want to, like, dig deeper, but no, really, where are you from? And
you kind of want to be in control of that identity. You want to be able to tell that story. You don't want someone to tell the story for you.
Well, what happens is when you label yourself, when you identify yourself, you give yourself power by self-definition, as opposed to somebody giving you a label and saying, she's Hispanic. You know, well, we don't accept that label. We say, you know, I'm a Chicana writer. If you want to label my literature, then we'll call it that, because those are the issues that I'm addressing. That self-definition at some point in this long career of ours, because it's been a whole generation that worked on that, eventually created a space. We didn't find the space. Nobody gave us that space. We created that space.
Ana Castillo will be at the Printers Row Lit Fest on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. in conversation with Chicago Tribune reporter Darlene Glanton. She's also going to be she's going to have a book party and a poetry reading tomorrow night at the Hilton Asmus Gallery. That's 760 North Well Street. What time is that going to be at?
6 p.m. and on.
6 p.m. And there'll be a lot of great Chicago poets that have worked with you. Now, who will be there?
Well, Carlos Cumpian, who is a longtime poetry activist, and he'll be reading from my book, Sandra Jackson Opoku from the South Side of Chicago, novelist. I'm so happy she's joining me. Susana Sandoval, who's a poet and who just ran for Senate. Good for her. Ben David Garza, who's an actor. Erica Hilton, whose gallery it is and is who's also a poet. I feel like I'm forgetting.
And many, many more.
And many more. There's a lineup
well, that's
of stars.
That's tomorrow night at the Hilton Asmus Gallery at 760 North Wells. And, of course, Printers Row Lit Fest on Saturday. Chicago author Ana Castillo, her new memoir, Black Dove, Mama, Mijo, and Me. Ana, thanks so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's go, 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 White Sox. Chicago's proud of you.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest tonight is one of the best broadcasters in baseball. Ken Hawk Harrelson has been broadcasting White Sox baseball games on television since 1990. The man behind phrases like, he gone, stretch, and you can put it on the board. Yes, he's broadcasting on a part-time basis this season. He's doing mostly road games only, but he still finds himself at the cell from time to time as a fan. Harrelson has a great playing career in baseball and even a better one in the booth, and he's my guest tonight on The Download. Hawk, thanks so much for being here.
Justin, my pleasure, buddy.
All right, so why don't we start with the elephant in the room, which is the White Sox right now. A very tough month of May that's continued into June. Some big news today, Matt Latos designated for assignment, and also the signing of Justin Morneau, who right away goes on the DL. Hawk, what do you think about where the Sox are right now?
Well, it's pretty, for me, it's pretty easy to figure out what's happened here. You know, we came out of spring training, and the ball club was on a big high. They were playing terrific baseball, got off to a 23-10 start in April on absolutely the worst schedule I have ever seen for a major league team. April and May were just brutal. April, there was one off day. May, I believe there were two or three off days. But they went through that schedule, all those tough road games and everything else, and they were 13 over. Yeah, but it's going to rear its head. That schedule was going to rear its ugly head, and where it was going to rear it was in the bullpen.
Yeah, we're seeing trouble there.
Because in April, you can't have the best bullpen in the big leagues in April and the worst in May. It just doesn't happen that way, unless there's a reason for it. One reason would be injuries, which we didn't have any. The other reason would be the schedule. And as I said, this schedule was the worst I've ever seen in my whole career. In fact, when I got, Bob Graham sent me the schedule before the season started. And I was having breakfast with my wife, and I looked at the schedule. I was going over. I said, honey, I said, this is the worst friggin' schedule I've ever seen.
And you're talking about not only the competition, but day off. There were no days off at the beginning of the season. They played straight through. There are a lot of road games. I mean, the Sox were handed a pretty difficult beginning to the season. But does that even itself out as the season goes on?
It will later on. But we're seeing the results of that April and May strain on the bullpen. Well, those guys, you know, your starters coming out of spring training, they're not going to be going a lot of innings. They're going to be going fewer innings than they will be later on in the season. So what does that mean? That means the bullpen's got to get up. And Robin had to get those guys up, and they were throwing, a lot of them were throwing, you know, four, five, six times a week in the bullpen. Not that they got in that many games, but they were throwing. And what happens is they got tired. There's no question about it. They got tired mentally, not so much physically. But it's the mental grind of getting up and throwing and getting up and throwing and getting up and throwing. And I told a friend of mine in Seattle who's a huge Sox fan, I told him, I said, this thing is going to catch us because you just can't have this kind of schedule and continue that adrenaline flow. That adrenaline flow is going to take its toll. And that's why it's a mental thing. It's not a physical thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've been around the game for a long time, Hawk. I mean, how important is it, the mental stress, not just the physical stress, but the mental stress that a baseball team goes through?
Oh, that's worse than the physical. There's no question about it. All things being equal as far as injuries go, you know, which we haven't had that many at all. And, in fact, when you got Herm Schneider and his group with out there, I'll tell you what, those guys go out, he keeps them on the field. But where it does get you is mentally. And the mental stress is worse than the physical stress, believe me.
Let's talk about you in the broadcast booth. I was looking at some of the articles recently, and a lot of fans pointed to the game against the Royals not too long ago, about 2-3 weeks ago, where the Sox blew that lead late, and it really felt like a turning point. And they turned to your call of the game, and there were some that said it sounded like you were almost in tears at the end, having to actually give the score at the end of that game. Talk about your relationship to your emotions when you're calling a game and trying to be an objective broadcaster, but at the same time being obvious that you're a Sox fan.
Well, there's no question. And the biggest compliment you can pay me is being a homer, and I am. And I'm a homer who does not gild a lily. You're seeing the same thing I am, and I give fans who are watching the ball game credit for Nord, or else they wouldn't be watching it. It's just that simple. And I broadcast the same way that I played. And people say, what's your style of broadcasting? And when I was on MLB Web Network not too long ago, they were asking, what's your style? And my style is I broadcast the same way I played. And one of the greatest, if not the greatest compliment I was ever paid was by a terrific manager named Alvin Dark, who managed, Giants. And we went to the World Series, Oakland, and all that stuff for a few times. And he said, of all the guys he ever managed, the guy who wanted to win a baseball game more than any other player he ever managed was Hawk Harrelson. And that, to me, was a tremendous compliment, because that's the way I was brought up, and that's the way I played the game. And I broadcast the same way. I want the Sox to win. And when they get beat, that's one thing. That's baseball. You know, Justin, you're going to win 60, you're going to lose 60. It's what you do with those other 42.
Right.
And if you waste those 42, that's what pisses me off. It really does. When that game is over, if we beat ourselves, there's not one player in that locker room who's more upset than I am. Not one. And when I'm driving home after that ball game, there's not one player leaving that ballpark who's more upset than I am. And when we win, it's just the opposite. I'm happy because of the fact. Now, in that Kansas City series, I've never seen a series like that.
Really? In all your time, you've never seen...
In 56 years, I've never seen a series like that. I've never seen a series where we had substantial leads late in the ball game and then blew them.
Yeah.
And the one of the reasons being is because the bullpen was tired. Look how many runs we gave up in that series late in the ball game. So it all reverts back to me, but I understand that it's going to stop.
Let me ask you, I'm fascinated on when the change happened, because when you talk about baseball announcing, you think of some of the greats like Vin Scully or Harry Carey and yourself. I mean, there is this homerism to it. There is this, hey, go team, go home team. When did baseball announcing make a move, in your estimation, to the middle where the announcers are much more objective and they don't show their emotions and they're not being as colorful as some of the people before?
I think it started back in the late 70s, early 80s, maybe middle 80s, it started going in the direction that you just alluded to. It's, you had guys back in those days who, let's say that compared to today's announcers, were unique.
Right.
Like you mentioned, Vin and Harry and Joe Buck and those guys. They wanted their clubs to win. I want the White Sox to win. And I don't care who knows it. And I'll tell you one thing about it, too, is a lot of times I have players on the White Sox team who are really pissed off at me because I get on them and I get on the club the way they're playing. But I don't care. I don't tell them how to play, and they don't tell me what to say.
Well, that's something that's been in your career, both for as an announcer being critical of your team, but also critical of the umpires or critical of the league. You've been one of the more outspoken announcers where you have been critical and you paid the price. You know, the MLB has said, yo, Hawk, back up. But talk about that relationship you have first with the team. Your booth partner, Steve Stone, went through that with the Cubs where, you know, they wanted him gone because Dusty Baker in those days. But talk about that relationship and how you have to play that dance when it comes to criticizing the home team.
There's no dancing. There's really not any dancing. I'm going to say what I feel like I have to say at the time, because my job is not to help the team. My job is to inform the viewer on what's going on, whether it be positive or negative. And that's the way I approach it, and I always have. And I got some advice early on in my career back in 1975 from Kurt Gowdy, who was, a Hall of Fame announcer, great announcer. And he called me up one day and says, Hawk, I want to come see you at the ballpark. I want to talk to you. This is my first year in 75 after I've been announcing a couple of months. So he came to the ballpark. He said, look, I'm going to give you some advice that you'll never forget, and it'll be the best advice you ever had. Don't try to please everybody, because you can't. And especially in a two-team city. He said, if you ever go, you know, to New York or Chicago, any of those two-team cities, you can't please everybody. So, and then about, I don't know, it was 3 weeks later, Howard Cosell called me up, came to the ballpark. He said, Hawk, it was eerie, Justin. It was like surreal. He said, I'm going to give you some of the best advice you ever get. Don't try to please everybody. Because you can't do it. He said, guys who try to please everybody don't last very long. And they're right.
They're right. You get it twice. They're right, right? You got to listen, now, right?
What I'm going to do is I'm going to broadcast the game, and I'm going to tell you what's going on. I'm going to tell you the psyche of that particular game, and I'm going to tell you what's going on. I'm going to tell you who screwed up, if it was a mental error or whatever it may be. And sometimes now, as you know, being a Sox fan, sometimes silence is the best communicator going.
There's a lot of silent moments in the last couple of weeks. I'll say that.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. In that Kansas City, that last game was just, you know, I've never seen a series. I've seen a game like that.
Right.
I think we were trailing in 1967. We were trailing the Angels by nine runs, going to the bottom of the ninth inning. We tied the ball game up and won it in 10.
That's baseball, right?
It's baseball. That's going to happen. But the way we did it, you know, it hurt me. I felt bad for the bullpen guys. I really did, because I knew they were tired. They had been up, throwing a lot. And it's a different game today. It's a different culture. And people who tell you the game has not changed, they don't know what they're talking about.
How so?
It's a six-inning game today. And thank goodness that Chris Sale had those three complete games. Or that bullpen would have been more wore out.
Yeah, right.
But it's a different game today. You got to understand that it's a six-inning game. And get to the seventh inning, here they come. You got the seventh inning guy, you got the eighth inning guy, you got the ninth inning guy. And I saw this coming about 20 years ago, maybe 24, 25 years ago. It was getting to be a bullpen game. The mantra when I played was, you're only going to go as far as your starting pitching will take you. The mantra today is, you're only going to go as far as your bullpen will take you.
Right.
And if your bullpen doesn't get it done, I don't care how good the starter goes, because he's only going to go, you know, 6-7 innings tops. You're going to lose.
Yeah.
It's just that simple. The two rules in baseball, first of all, you got to catch the ball. That's number one. Second rule is, don't mess with Joe West. And then you got to have a good bullpen. If you can go by those rules, you're probably going to win.
You're going to win. That's great. Hawk, I've noted, I mean, obviously this year you're doing the part-time schedule, doing road games. It's tough to come in and out from where you live in Indiana to do the home games. But let's talk about how long you're going to be doing this. I've seen a couple little nods in newspaper articles. Is this Hawk's last hurrah? Is this his last season? And I've also seen you say, and you know, hey, I hope to die in the booth. So is this your last hurrah?
No. I told Jerry last year after the season was over that I was going to cut back the schedule. He said, you know, and I told him I wanted to do all road games to get rid of this 200-mile-a-day drive, you know, and living in the eastern zone and working in the central zone.
Yeah.
For night games, that just didn't work out too well.
Right.
So he was happy that he wanted me 2 years ago to get my schedule cut back so I could cut out some of these, you know, these 200-mile-a-day trips. So I told him, I said, look, I'm going to try it. If I don't like it, this is going to be my last year. I said, if I like it, I'll just keep going. He said, well, do what you want to do.
So do you like it?
I love it.
All right.
I was at my grandson's game yesterday. I was able last week to go down to Warsaw and watch them both play in a tournament. You know, I got a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, and I'm not going to miss that. So this gives me the opportunity now. And my wife, Eris, it gives us the opportunity, options that we haven't had. You know, we've been married almost 43 years, and it gives us options that we never had. It gives me certainly options to see my grandchildren play, and I'm not going to blow that.
Hawk Harrelson is the play-by-play announcer for the Chicago White Sox, longtime one of the best broadcasters in baseball. Hawk, thanks so much for taking some time out, and we hope to have you again here on The Download.
All right, well, listen, I'm not trying to walk you off the ledge. I'm going to say, and this thing's going to end, and we are going to be fine.
All right, that's what we like to hear.
All right, Justin.
All right. Hawk Harrelson. I should have done my impression. That would have been a good way to end that. He gone. You know. Stretch! Oh, Jake. My favorite is when he gets, or stay fair. He's wheeling the baseball. There's a lot. I knew this was going to happen. I said in the intro and the outro, one of the best broadcasters in baseball. And the Cubs fans, I'm assuming, that are sort of loyal, great listeners here to WGN Radio, mm-hmm. disagree with that assessment.
He's a polarizing broadcaster.
I've never seen him and Stoney together, I think, make a great combination of two really great folksy baseball announcers. Steve Stone will always be in our hearts, mm-hmm. regardless of either side of town, based on, you know, that sort of relationship he had with Harry Carey, where he'd be like, well, Harry.
Yeah.
Well, Harry, all the youngsters out there. Right? And then, and of course, you know, they just, I like their report. I understand people don't like his folksy tone, Hawk's tone, but I like it.
I don't know. Again, as I said earlier, I don't understand the vitriol that people have with broadcasters. He has a personality. Would you rather have this than, right. or the, you know, the his style, or just the, you know, the generic style of broadcasting that you're getting more of, as you pointed out?
The only broadcasting I get upset with is probably football. When it's dun 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 dun, they show the beautiful skyline of Chicago, and we're playing like the Rams in week 4, and they're like, "Hello, everybody!" Blah blah blah. And it's the C team, you know, and it's like it's the old guy who never really hit it, and then on top of it, the jock former safety from the Vikings who's now trying broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
That's the worst. When you get that game, you know it gives you a signal of what. The NFL thinks of your team.
Yeah. I understand that. But, you know, I'm not going to, like, criticize Tom Thayer for liking the Bears too much.
Yeah, right.
You know, like your home team broadcaster. But, yeah, the national broadcasters.
When we were at the GN Walk of Fame, Wayne Larrivee was there.
Yeah.
That was
That's a voice.
I got real, like, fanboy.
Yeah.
Like when I walked up to him and I'm like, Mr. Larrivee, you don't know me. I'm Justin. I'm just a guy. I'm on the radio. I'm on late night. I'm like, would you come on our show? He's like, I'd love to. And I was like, ah. And then I was standing next to Wally Podrajic, who's a guy from the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Mm-hmm. Who I've worked with Wally. He's a teacher at USC for years. And he's like, who's that? And I'm like, you call yourself a historian. You don't know your history. I'm like, it's one of the best calls in sports history. Wayne Larrivee. And it's when he called the 85 Bears championship game against the Rams, and they do that thing at the beginning, which you and I both are just like, how does anyone do that? Split back, top, head start, hike, that, you know, like you do that broadcasting on the radio for football. I'm always like, I don't even know what you just said, Joniak. I don't even know.
I know.
But Larrivee would do the same thing. Split side left, wide receivers to the right, in the backfield, split backfield, Matsui, you know. But it was the Bears when they Dent sacked the Rams quarterback. I can't remember who it was. Mm-hmm. And the ball, it was a fumble, and Wilbur Marshall picked it up.
Yes.
That call, Wayne Larrivee has that call with Buckus in the background, like, go, go, go. That's iconic. Like, it's the call. I don't think there's any other call in Chicago sports. When I think of Cubs, I'm like, there's Cubs win and stuff, but and maybe a Brick House, kind of Ernie Banks, 500.
Yeah.
Maybe that I would put Hawk's complete game or Burley's perfect game.
Hmm.
He's like, he said, right before the ninth inning, call your daughter, call your son, call everybody. We got history here in Chicago. Like, this is a great call he had. Maybe Johnny Red Kerr and some of the Bulls stuff.
Yeah.
But they do it differently there. That when the Bulls get to the Eastern Conference Finals, Johnny Red Kerr and those guys they're not doing it anymore. So, you know, I think that call, that Larrivee call, is probably the biggest one.
I love that the video with the snow coming down. Yeah, this is great.
Go, go,
yeah.
go.
Buckus. Wayne Larrivee, I'll never forget. This is one of. I don't know if he'll remember this, but it was a faux pas, and I always remember it because it was right after 9/11.
Okay.
And
a 9/11 faux pas. Continue.
And it was the first college football game after 9/11. It was like Michigan or something. Sure. And, you know, the game's over, the band's kind of playing, and it's just regal, and there's like flags over, and Wayne is going on this like great, I mean, it's just like a wonderful sentiment about the game and sports and life and and then at the end he's like, and we'll never forget what happened on September 12th.
Before the date was like lodged into our
I think memory. So yeah, it was, so, you know, obviously
when we would think back, when was that? Is that the 11th or 12th? Wow, that is a faux pas. That's
I'm sure you didn't even realize it, probably, but I was rolling on my
date,
VCR.
Yeah, when
so.
You're close to the date, I guess that's a mistake you could make. I would think like now you would, that'd be hilarious that someone goes, remember September 12th. All right, coming up, John Lankford is here, the former member of the Mekons. He's currently with the Waco Brothers. They're playing at Ribfest this weekend, tomorrow. Excited to talk to John. John's great. If you're a Chicago fan of, or a fan of Chicago musicians and music, you know John Lankford. He has been such a big part of the alt country scene, but the rock and roll scene here for a long time. First time we've had him on the show, which is amazing, and he's going to be here with Bethany Thomas playing live music coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, this weekend is Ribfest, and what better way to enjoy smoked meats than to mosey up to the stage and enjoy the music of John Lankford. Lankford is playing on Friday with his band, the Waco Brothers. John Lankford is one of Chicago's musical treasures. He moved here in the early 90s. The Welsh-born musician was in the punk band, the Mekons, and he's currently playing with the Waco Brothers, the Men of Gwent, and on occasion, the Pine Valley Cosmonauts, not so much anymore. The Waco Brothers released a new record this spring called Going Down in History. Lankford is a punk rock musician who's brought country, western, and folk traditions into the fold. Lankford and others like Robbie Fulk, Sally Timms, Freakwater, and Robin Nan at Bloodshot Records are credited with bringing alt country to the forefront here in Chicago. John Lankford is in studio with me tonight with vocalist Bethany Thomas. Bethany, John, good to see you.
Hey, how are you?
Why don't we start with a song? Why don't we break format for once? What? Let's start with a song, John. What are we going to hear here?
We're going to do a song. It's a new song. We performed it live once. So me, Tony Newsom, who you know,
of
as
course,
well,
yeah,
he's been on a PZ with, back in the day. We've got this strange project which we're going to go to Muscle Shoals in November and record with basically a lot of very talented older gentlemen who. It's produced by Norman Putnam, and he was Elvis's bass player, one of the Nashville Cats, and the kind of the original bass player at Muscle Shoals. And David Hood's going to play on it, and a bunch of other guys whose resumes are terrifying.
Well, they're terrified of you, so that works.
I don't know if they are.
What's the name?
I think they just don't quite understand what I am. But we're going to have a nice weekend in Muscle Shoals. So this All song's right. called Thought He Was Dead. It's kind of about A.P. Carter, who was, I suppose he was Johnny Cash's great uncle-in-law or something like that, but who still, you know, the great song collector from the Carter family. But he disappeared, and people thought he was dead, and then he turned up on a radio station one day.
No.
Pretty much like this.
Just like this.
So this song actually echoes this situation.
There we go. John Lankford, accurately. Bethany Thomas. Here we go.
All right, here we go.
No, don't turn that dial. You're only for a big surprise. He was still alive. I thought he was dead, but he sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean, moving his old way. It's getting so you can't afford to die. He sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean, moving
his old way.
There's $95 or $96 right here in an envelope for you.
Well, don't be putting that overcoat on. We want another number. We want another song. I thought he was dead, but he sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean, moving his old way.
It's getting so you can't afford to die.
He sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean, moving his old way. Find him sitting by the back door, listening to the radio. Long strides down the railroad track, never on the road, he give anything away. He gave away everything. He might wait till you offer to pay, then he'd just give it away. I thought he was dead, but he sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean, moving his old way. It's getting so you can't afford to die. Well, he sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean, moving his old way.
There you go. John Langford and Bethany Thomas in studio here. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thanks.
You're only the second person in the world to hear it.
I was going
to
say, and the download
in the world.
Yeah, second audience. So talk about why play that song. I'm interested in the songs that you choose to play for both of you, to all the songs in the world. What attracts you to this type of music, this type of song?
I don't know. I'm just really – I was invited to go down to Muscle Shoals and work down there through a connection. I was artist in residence at the Country Music Hall of Fame last year, and it's a big exhibit about Dylan and Cash and the Nashville Cats, and it was great. I went down and met them. I did illustrations and for the catalog and the exhibit, and then actually got to sing with some of the guys. It was basically the guys I sang with were people who played on like Blonde on Blonde and Neil Young's Harvest, and it was quite incredible actually. And I felt a bit overawed. But it was actually also that kind of great rite of passage to be able to stand up with these guys. And I sang a couple of Johnny Cash songs in the Country Music Hall of Fame. Oh. And afterwards got talking to Norbert Putnam, who was actually Elvis's bass player at the very end, of last guy to play bass with Elvis, in the Jungle Room a few weeks before he died. And he just said, "You got to come down to Muscle Shoals and record down there, John."
Obviously, with your pedigree in music, with the Mekons and the Waco Brothers and all the bands and all the music, do you still find yourself intimidated or sort of like a kid in a candy shop when you're talking about going to the Country Music Hall of Fame?
No, that's been really great, because I didn't think I was very interested in the Country Music Hall of Fame. I thought it was going to be, you know, Garth Brooks underpants in a box or something like that, you know. But it's a deeply scholarly and passionate place, particularly this exhibit that I've been involved in, because they wanted to honor the guys. The Nashville Cats were the guys who, you know, made Nashville the city it is. So they kind of used Dylan and Cash as a front for that. But really, the exhibits are making all the connections between who exactly recorded in Nashville in the 60s and why it became such a focus for music, and why it wasn't really a, you know, conservative right-wing kind of place.
Yeah, and you hear that more and more. I mean, the country music that I guess is in the mainstream is not the country music that sort of built that town.
Well, that town was built on, you know, recording, and a lot of people from the counterculture went there and found it a very kind of comfortable place to be. I think a lot of bad things happened, you know, in the 70s, and then by the 80s and the 90s, country music had really kind of shut up shop and got moved to the suburbs, and was this kind of suburban rock music that you've got now. you know, which mm-hmm. is, rather than cheating and drinking and killing, it's all sort of, you know,
yeah.
God and the Flag type songs, which, I don't know.
Uplifting.
Don't really, right. they don't really interest me all that much, Bethany, much what, as the cheating and the killing.
But. Yeah, sure. What brings you, I mean, as a musician, as a singer, what's it like to sing John's songs? And what is it, you know, to be a part of the group that brings you to this country music that John has been pursuing?
I very much like John's company.
That's good enough.
Good work.
It's a friend of mine. Case closed. I think I'm attracted to... I always am interested in singing new kinds of things. Obviously, country is not a new genre, but... somebody like me who's coming a bit more from like the theater world, he's always bringing me stuff that I'm not getting anywhere else, which is what is appealing to me. And then on top of it, when he says like, oh, and then we're going to take it down to Muscle Shoals and record, then it's like, yeah,
okay, right,
I can get into this. Yeah.
It's an odd thing because it's, you know, I wanted it to be about my understanding of that part of American history, and Muscle Shoals was this great place where, you know, black and white people made music together, and it wasn't like self-conscious. Mm-hmm. It seemed just like very natural, and there seemed to be something going on down there with those guys that they could. Norbert Putnam said, well, I used to play black music, then I moved to Nashville, and then they told me I was playing white music, but really I was playing the same thing, you know. And just, it's, I think that's a really interesting and kind of golden age of, you know, American music. So most of these songs were written in Nashville when I was down there, because I was down there for quite a long time, and I kind of scouted around the Hall of Fame and thought about things I might want to write about, and obscure little, you know, bits of trivia popped into my brain. But I think there's a kind of like, you know, working with Tony and Bethany as well, they come from a different sort of vibe altogether. So,
well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and continue the conversation. John Langford in studio, Bethany Thomas as well. Maybe we'll get another song out of you guys coming up here. Ribfest is this weekend, Friday night. The Waco Brothers are playing. You can find John there. And then we'll also, I mean, where are you guys playing next? Are you playing with them at Ribfest or no?
No, I won't be. I was not invited to Ribfest.
It's as simple as that. You can come.
Yeah,
you've been on stage with the Waco Brothers before.
Maybe you will. Maybe you will. You got nothing going on. All right. We'll be back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. My guests tonight, John Langford and Bethany Thomas in studio. John's with the Waco Brothers at Ribfest this weekend, Friday night, and also working on a project with Bethany and Tawny Newsom, who is... not here today, but she is.
She is in town.
She's in town.
She's
that's good.
In
that's
Chicago, but
that's
she
a start.
She's far too busy to hang out with us tonight.
Yep. So we were talking about. I wanted to talk about Chicago when it comes to country music and history, because Nashville obviously has a huge, huge imprint on country music as we know it, both the kind that you're playing and the stuff you're talking about in suburban. But in Chicago, talk about how you got involved in the makings of an alt-country scene here in Chicago.
Well, I sort of stumbled into that without really knowing anything about the history. And to your point about Nashville having that thing about country, I mean, they took everything from Chicago, because the WLS Barn Dance was here first. And that was such a huge success. Some people in Nashville thought, oh, we should have something like that in Nashville. And that's when the Grand Ole Opry, where that came from. I used to come here with the Mekons in the 80s.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the first building I ever went in, apart from the airport, was the Metro. And
what do you remember about Chicago from that time, from touring it?
It was, for me, I came with the Three Johns, this kind of like heavy metal art school disco band we had, and then the Mekons. And I thought Chicago was somewhere where I could relax and was comfortable. It seemed more familiar. We were playing in L.A., San Francisco, you know, New York. It was all, we were staying in hotels. And in Chicago, we actually had some friends, so we kind of stayed around people's houses, had a couple of days off, and got a feel for the place. And it felt very much like, I came from industrial South Wales and moved to go to college to in the industrial north of England. And then I moved to live in Chicago. And it really, there's a lot more in common with these places I've lived. I've always lived somewhere where, you know, something's just shut down.
Maybe that informs your music a little bit, right?
Yeah, possibly, but... So I came, and one night we were playing the Cubby Bear. At that point, it was, I don't know why, the Mekons had this reputation. We'd done an album called Fear and Whiskey, which some people said like was the first rock band to kind of bring country music. I don't think that's the truth. I think there's loads of people doing it. But we just, you know, we didn't make an album that sounded like country music, but it was heavily informed by country music. So people used to turn up at our gigs in like cowboy hats and cowboy shirts, and we go, where'd you get those shirts? And they go, oh, Alcala's on Chicago Avenue. So we go down there, we get all this gear, we buy like, you know, hats and everything a British, you know, rock musician shouldn't really be wearing. And then, you know, after the show, I forget where it was, but somebody said, do you want to go to the Sundowners Ranch? You know, I'd been kind of vaguely looking for, I'd really got into honky-tonk classic country and western music, and was shocked when I came here that it wasn't everywhere. It wasn't on the radio. You couldn't find it anywhere. So somebody took us down to the Sundowners Ranch on Randolph Street, and there were these guys that played five nights a week, and they played like from 8 o'clock till 5 in the morning. Trio, country and western. They did the whole thing. Both types of music. They did the three-part harmony, so they would do like Gene Autry songs, who also was from the Chicago, W.S. Barnard star. And the first night we got there, because we were dressed in all this gear from Alcala's, the Sundowners say, do you want to get up? Come on, come and get up. You know, looks like we got a band here. Come and get up.
Country Western band.
Really, they wanted to get off the stage so they could get a cocktail.
You're right.
But they said, so we were like, no, we can't. They said, no, come on up. And the guitarist did stay, Don Walls. He was a wonderful guy, and he stayed and played with us, and he really didn't care that we were complete rubbish. But it was a learning moment, and I thought, I'm going to go away. I'm going to learn a few songs, and when I come back, next time I'm back in Chicago, I'm going to get up there.
Wow.
And I'm going to be really good. And I'm like Johnny Cash or something like that, Merle Haggard. So I learned a few songs.
Did you make it back?
I did. I used to go back. When I moved to Chicago in 91, I didn't have anywhere to live. And I was staying at my girlfriend's parents' house for a while, which was kind of, you know, humbling.
Yeah, it is what it is, right?
But we go out to the Sundowners Ranch. By then, had moved up by the airport to Mannheim Row, and they called it the Sundowners Ranch, so... And that was my only place to go.
You were ready to come back. You're like, I'm back, and I've got songs.
I'd get up there, I'd sing, and they, you know, and people would be drunk. It'd be a Saturday night, and no one would try to kill me. And I felt like it was like I've done the initiation. Now I can sing. I may be from Wales, but I can get up there and sing country in front of, you know, badass country and western fans
on Mannheim Road. I love it.
Yeah, they played my wedding.
The guys
were great, and they were the real thing, and it really was, and they were the tail end of that. They moved up here, all from the south, and they moved up here. They had the Sundowners Ranch and the R&R Ranch for 36 years. You know, and they were like, they came here because this was the place to go for country music. And there were so many people from, you know, Appalachian people, southern people here. So,
John Langford in studio with us, longtime musician here in Chicago with the Waco Brothers and, of course, the Mekons. Can we hear another track?
Shall I do a Waco song?
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great.
I'll do a Waco song, and then maybe we can do another new thing later.
His study is written by the winner. This is a loser's song. I took this job in the summer. Never saw the winter rolling on. I never thought it would end in a second. A burnout smoking wreck. Expectations and ambition just a rope around my neck. Broke my back to earn a crust. I saw my dreams die in the dust. Now I'm walking on hell's roof looking at the flowers. Walking on hell's roof looking at the flowers. All in bloom. Red, yellow, and blue. So sweet and true. There's nothing better to do. Well, I'm not hiding, come and find me. What am I doing? There's no need to remind me. Walking on hell's roof, looking at the flowers. In the air to be in the miles per hour. Keeping out of reach of the higher power. Where the bees are buzzing in the April showers. The spoils belong to the victor. This is a consolation song. Your life is science fiction. In a flash then you'll be gone. No more trials and no more troubles. Bad luck and bursting bubbles. Walking on hell's roof looking at the flowers. Yeah, we've been walking on hell's roof looking at the flowers.
John Langford in studio here. It's very good. Thank you for that. The Waco Brothers, the new record was out this spring called Going Down in History. They will be playing at the Rib Fest coming up here Friday night.
8 p.m. at the North Stage.
The North Stage.
The North Stage. There's two stages.
We'll continue our
conversation. You have to get about 500 stalls full of cooked meat to get to us.
There's a lot of cooked meat. A lot of smoked cooked meat at Ribfest. We'll continue our conversation after the news here with John Langford and Bethany Thomas here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, John Langford, also Bethany Thomas. Thanks for being here, you guys. And playing music today, John Langford, of course, with the Mekons and the Waco Brothers. Waco Brothers with a new record called Going Down in History. They're also playing at Ribfest Friday night, 8 o'clock, the North Stage. John, let me ask you just, you know, one of the things that, I mean, you've had such an accomplished career in music, and you continue to work with younger musicians and bringing people in.
Well, they're all younger.
Yeah. I mean, but you
like
know,
older people,
a lot of people come through, and maybe they'll work with you at the Hideout. But you're really open to working with other musicians and actually nurturing and developing them as in their careers. Why do you do that? Why are you interested in the youth of America here?
Well, it's the youth, but I work a lot with older people as well. Like, 'cause I've done stuff with Andre Williams, and I've done stuff with Roger Knox, this Aboriginal country and western singer. So I go both ways. You know, I swing both ways. Like I'm old, like I'm young. I don't know. I just like collaborating. It doesn't really matter. Sometimes young people have more energy that I can feed on, I suppose. You know?
Bloodshot Records puts it in your bio that you're sort of the Papa Bear to the Bloodshot family in the way that you sort of help young musicians navigate the music industry.
Yeah, down through the years, I suppose I have.
What are the things that you talk or give advice to young musicians? Because you've been through it. I mean, with the Mekons,
the money. You don't leave anything behind.
But one of the things I read is, you know, that one of the quotes is keep your head down and keep moving forward. What does that mean?
For me, I don't, not to, to second guess too many things and not to worry about things or to dwell on. The Mekons actually, you know, do not dwell on their failures. We actually celebrate them and turn them into victories. And that's how we've survived. So
talk about the Mekons. I mean, you guys were able to work together. I mean, but 2014 was a big year.
Band formed in 77. I was 19 when that band formed, and now I'm like 83. So it's been going
But I mean, it was
well.
Right. I mean, the Mekons came off the success. Not the success. I mean, sort of was inspired by the Sex Pistols.
It was the cultural kind of schism created by the Sex Pistols when suddenly it was like one sort of music was all rubbish and you shouldn't listen to that anymore. And then we didn't know what the new music was, but everything that was old was rubbish. So there had to be something new. So then it gave everyone this amazing freedom to do anything. We took the premise that you didn't actually really even have to be able to play an instrument to be in a band, which was quite a leap at any other point in history. But then it made total sense.
It made sense in the late 70s, right?
You know, we don't do that anymore because obviously people have learned that, but it was a freeing thing in the initial days of doing it.
I think it's interesting. You had as a 19-year-old kid talking about, you know, doing something new, open frontier when it comes to music. And as you've grown older, you've looked towards the past. You've looked towards music like folk music or country western to almost enrich the music that you're playing.
Quite early on, we used to butt into people. You know, we'd find people on our little path and. Like people in studios, other musicians, and they would tell us things about ourselves that we didn't know. And the second album, we were making an album for Virgin, they sacked us halfway through the album. We were left with a studio bill, and but the engineer there was a guy who'd worked with the Sex Pistols, but he'd also worked in the kind of English folk circuit. And the studio we'd accidentally picked out of the Yellow Pages was one of the premier studios for English folk music, and the guy who owned it was like the Alan Lomax of Britain. He was called Bill Leader. And he'd made all these kind of grassroots kind of field recordings of it. So he said, you know, he looked and said, you know, all your mistakes, that's the mistakes and the fact that you don't play, it's functional. You're making functional music because you have to make it. And you're the opposite of like people who make this comfortable, easy listening music because they can play too well. You can't play well enough, but it gives your music this kind of edge. And this was, you know, this is an old folky type guy telling us this. And then when we first met Terry Nelson, who was a DJ on ZRD here in Chicago. He came to England in the 80s. He said,
The Mekons, you're like a punk, you're a punk band, but you're like a country and western band. We go, well, don't be ridiculous. It's the worst music ever. Country and western, can't stand that. He goes, no, but all your songs are about drinking in bars and failed sexual relationships, and they're all three chords. And it was like, maybe he's onto something.
Is that when you started to explore the music?
He gave me a cassette tape called Honky Tonk Classics Volume 1, and it was Merle Haggard, Hank Thompson, George Jones, Jerry Lee Lewis's country stuff, and Ernest Tubb. And I heard Ernest Tubb, and I was like, this guy can play guitar about as well as I can. And he can't really sing, but he's fantastic. And all the songs were about real life. And they were about, you know, things that we were like 25 by that time. We felt we'd loved and lost a bit and lived a life. And to hear this stuff, this world-weary stuff, you know, about drinking and cheating and killing people was all, you know.
Well, I mean, country western experience. I mean, as you said, there's a lot of roots of that music. The other music in town, which is, this is the blues capital of the world. I mean, you came to Chicago, and there is this tremendous rich history of musicians being able to tell their story or to live the life that they're singing about. Do you think that there's something more than just, I like Chicago, it was chill, and the reason that you came here?
Exactly. I came here and I found things here that I was fascinated by. I mean, the blues stuff as well, obviously. I veered towards the country and western thing because I kind of felt a little awkward, you know, playing the blues. I didn't want to be Sting, you know, like the white guy playing reggae and, you know, or Eric Clapton. But it's actually odd because I went to see the Kinsey Report at Roses a few weeks ago, and Donald Kinsey got me up on stage, and it was a bit like the Sundowners moment. Suddenly I'm in a packed blues club, and then I'm up there, and I'm right. I've got 3 minutes now. And he hands me his guitar, and he goes, go on in, play something. And his band are all like, right, okay. Unfortunately, I had a...
Did you have a blues song ready?
A song, yeah.
See, it goes over through this song. You've adapted.
And you know what? And I focused myself with such incredible focus, because I wasn't very focused at that point. And I was wearing shorts, which is always, I think, the last thing you want to see on stage in a blues club is my white Welsh knees. You know, I would have asked my money back if I was, you know.
You've created a tremendous following for your music, for your country western music here. It's interesting because as an English guy playing country western,
I'm not English though. See,
so Welsh,
I'm
Welsh
south.
Guy.
I'm from the south.
You're from the south.
South Wales.
You're South Wales. So Welsh guy playing country western.
It's not really country western, is it? We've been informed by that, but we were informed as much by all these other things. I don't know what it is. This new stuff we're doing now is a kind of mess of folk, soul, country, you know, all. But like I said, functional music, that sort of music that kind of comes from the grassroots up, that has to be made, that people make. It's not like dictated from, right, you know, boardroom somewhere where it's like, it'd be really good if we had a band that did something like this.
You know? That's coming. You know that's coming too. Well, we need more John Langford. Get it. Get me
no
a John Langford.
No one needs that. No one needs that.
Well, John Langford's my guest tonight. Bethany Thomas is also your vocalist. Let's hear a track, if you will, a new one you said you were going to play.
Yeah,
what do you got?
We've got two new tracks we're going to play for you today, and this is the second one. And it mentions radio as well.
All right. You're John Langford.
Well, our songs are obsessed with radio.
We like it. Perfect venue. Bethany Thomas, take it away.
I smell the smoke, I feel the flames, so pull the truck into the garage. A holdout full of cash and a change of name, we're heading back to Poor Valley. Dark and true lover on the whispering radio, a message from the heart of the world. Back in Poor Valley, one lonely orphan child is riding the airwaves into space. When the house burnt down, she came back to town, smoke still on her clothes. She bought a new guitar, plans to stay right here, roots deep in the ground. We nudge the car beneath a shady apple tree and set our vows in the back seat.
When I die, baby, will you bury me up on a hill, standing upright in a glass coffin, so I can see the land that slipped right through my hands, and we'll stay here in Poor Valley. It's not where I belong, but things kept going wrong. Everything I had is gone. Well, she got drunk.
She got drunk.
She got sick. Her hands seized up. Her voice got paper thin. Now who in the world is gonna help? These songs ain't gonna sing themselves. Dark haired true lover on the whispering radio, a message from the heart of the world. Back in Poor Valley, one lonely orphan child is riding the airwaves, riding the airwaves into space.
Yeah, there we go. John Langford and Bethany Thomas. I can't thank you guys enough. It's so wonderful to be in studio and listen to you guys play. The new Waco Brothers record is called Going Down in History. Bethany, John, and Tawny, we'll get something from you guys hopefully by the fall, right? I mean, that's the idea.
We're recording in November. So
okay, yeah, all right.
I should imagine it'll be a 2017 release.
I was going to say, just turn it around. You turn around in like a week. It's the new world
that's
order, right?
That's how they did it way back when, right?
Yeah, no, maybe it'll be number one in the charts in November.
Norbert knows how to take care of business,
exactly.
I'm sure.
He wants to work fast. We want to work fast, so yeah.
I can't thank you guys enough for coming in. Thanks for being here.
Great, nice to be here.
John Langford is playing with the Waco Brothers at Rib Fest. It's Friday night at 8 o'clock at the North Stage here in Chicago. Woo! That was a show. Exhausted. That's how you do it, right? It's a lot of conversation, a lot of music, a lot of great Chicago people. And I mean, we got R.L. Stine was on the show tonight. How great is that? Coming up tomorrow, we continue. I'm so excited about tomorrow. I can't contain myself. Fred Wesley, one of the best trombonists in the history of music, I would say. He was a member of the JB's, James Brown's band. He's headlining at the Blues Festival on Saturday night. Fred Wesley and the new JB's. We're talking to Fred Wesley about his career in the James Brown band. And then when that fizzled out, he just decided to go indie. He started playing with Parliament Funkadelic, George Clinton. There's a lot of stories in that trombone. A lot of stuff got hidden up in that trombone. We'll talk to him about that. And also, Kim Barker's going to be here. She was she's a great author. She was Chicago Tribune, South Asian reporter for a long time, bureau reporter. And we'll talk with her about her new book, Taliban Shuffle. A lot of stuff. And the frying pan. Steve Gadlin returns Friday night. So we got a great show again tomorrow night here on The Download.